Cramps Podcast number 137, and today we're talking about wings and ground effect, and in particular, ground effect over waves. So wings and ground effect, or WIG, is where you put your aircraft close to the ground to make it generate a lot more lift, like 20 or 30% more lift, with not a lot of a drag penalty, and usually the lift-to-drag ratio increases dramatically. We actually did a podcast on just general ground effect a long time ago, podcast number 9, and we went through how this works. This is actually one of our most popular podcasts on Spotify, so check that out if you don't know about the flow physics of a ground effect. And then come back to this one and listen to how the ground effect of an airfoil over waves occurs and how it affects the performance. So because in this podcast, we're going through this ground effect over waves, as I mentioned. So how does this wavy ground affect a wing's performance? We're going to be looking at this paper, which is called Airfoil Aerodynamics in Proximity to a Wavy Ground for a Wide Range of Angles of Attack. So this paper isn't just looking at one angle of attack, but a wide range of angles of attack. And you can find this in the link in the description. It's open access, so you can access it and read it along if you wish, or if you're just listening to this, you can watch the video on YouTube and or Spotify. So in this paper, they're going to be looking at a NACA 4412 airfoil. And this is a very typical airfoil, and it approximates a lot of airplane wings. So for example, a Boeing 747, for example, it's not exactly a NACA 4412, but it is quite similar because, you know, a airliner wing has a lot more components. They have maybe the flaps at the back, the Kruger flaps, slots, etc. So a NACA 4412 is really just a general analog of a more complex wing, and it gives very similar flow physics. So the motivation for this is a lot of aircraft are used for low altitude operations. They might fly over buildings, trees, hills, or even water. To understand the ground effect on flat ground is very useful because, for example, when you land a plane, you're over usually flat ground, like the runway is very flat. But there are other phases of flight that might experience uneven ground. So this research is there to help bridge that gap. And in this research, the airfoil is traveling at 30 meters per second at a Reynolds number of 1 million. So that means that this airfoil is traveling in a fully turbulent flow. And this is much easier to simulate than if the Reynolds number was like 200,000, for example. When you're in like the transitional regime, it becomes very difficult to simulate the aerodynamics of an airfoil. So pushing it to the very turbulent range or to a very laminar range, that is much more easy to simulate. So with this airfoil, they have their setup here in figures one and two, I should say. And they set the airfoil at a height of 10% of the chord away from the ground. So the airfoil is 50 centimeters in chord, so it's 5 centimeters away from the ground. And they looked at angles of attack ranging from 0 degrees to 18 degrees. So the interesting thing about 18 degrees is that NACA 4412 airfoils will start to stall around that range, maybe around about 15 degrees to 20 degrees, depending on the Reynolds number. At a Reynolds number of 1 million, it's around 18 degrees actually. So let's talk about the wavy ground and how they modeled this, because this is quite difficult to do in CFD. So they modeled the wavy ground to follow a sine wave with an amplitude of 5% of the airfoil's chord and a wavelength of 5 times the airfoil's chord. This wave geometry was chosen to line up with other studies so that they can compare the results of this study with other studies that have been done in the past. And there have been a few other studies that have looked at airfoils, and as they mentioned, they usually just looked at one angle of attack, but here they're looking at many angles of attack. And to look into this, they're doing CFD. They're not doing experiments, and we'll get into that in a second, why they didn't and how they use experiments to validate their CFD. But let's just talk about their CFD setup. So the computational domain is very big, which is good. So the inlet and the top are located 20 chords upstream and away and like above the airfoil. And the outlet is located 25 chords downstream from the trailing edge. So that's very nice too. And the way they simulated the wavy ground is quite interesting. So how they did it was that they made the bottom surface have a wavy pattern, and then the bottom surface moves along. So you have this bottom surface and it just moves along with time as you simulate the flow. Now this means that the waves were rigid and very uniform. Both of these aspects are not 100% applicable in the real world because waves are obviously, they obviously break and are not exactly identical sine waves, nor are they rigid in the sense that the airfoils don't affect them. In real life, there is a coupling effect between the airfoil and the surface of the water. So when you have an airfoil going over the water, the pressure underneath will really affect the wave and sort of disperse it a little bit, and that will change the wave's shape. So here, because they have a rigid wave form, this is not 100% applicable to the real life, but it is a general analog and it is decent for a first approximation. So the authors acknowledge these limitations and argue that here the work is still valuable because it is a starting point for us to understand more about this phenomenon, and I agree. So when you look at this geometry, the airfoil is pretty much the same size as the wave's wavelength, which I personally didn't get a great appreciation for when I was just reading this paper to begin with, when I was just read the numbers up here that was talking about how big the waves were. But when you look at the picture, the airfoil is pretty much of the same kind of magnitude as one full wavelength. So that means that the airfoil, it could pretty much be engulfed in an entire wave, and we're not really that far away from the wave, so that's quite interesting. So here, another important thing to notice is that because the airfoil's chord is like one entire wavelength, this is likely to have quite a big effect on an airfoil. So if you have lots of smaller waves, like the wavelength is very small, when you're flying over it, you might have 5 or 10 waves underneath the entire airfoil's chord. So that means that when one wave sort of sheds away, another wave comes in, and that process probably won't affect the airfoil very much because there are so many other waves in there. But when you have one big wave, let's say you have the airfoil traveling over just one of the waves, it might go over the peak first. That's going to affect the airfoil's performance, and then it goes over a trough, and the entire airfoil is almost entirely in a trough. So that's going to affect its airfoil, its performance there as well. And that will probably affect the center of pressure, as we'll get into in a little bit. So back to the CFD setup. They used URANs with a time step of 0.00015 seconds, which is fairly low. That meant that they have a Courant number which is below 1, and this is very good. So just a refresher on what the Courant number is, it's actually very important for CFD. So the Courant number effectively tells us how far a particle of air will travel between time steps. For example, if the Courant number is 10, that means that the particle of air that we're looking at will travel through 10 cells in one time step. Whereas if the Courant number is 0.5, then the particle will only travel through half a cell in one time step. This is an important parameter because if you have your particles moving through too many cells each time step, then your simulation has to transfer a lot of information past several cells, and that makes the equations inherently less accurate. So a Courant number below 1 is always advisable, with the only exception being that when you don't have the resources to drop your time step low enough to achieve that. And the reason why below 1 is good is because then you are solving the information that the particles in each cell are having, instead of having to map these particles jumping between cells and skipping cells and trying to figure out how all this information is interacting with each other when you're skipping steps effectively. So having a Courant number of 1 helps you keep track of what's happening, and it greatly increases the accuracy of your simulation. Now, I should mention that what I just described there, this explanation is a bit simple for the Navier-Stokes CFD, which actually doesn't solve each particle, but this is the general idea of the Courant number. So one thing that has become increasingly common for researchers is to use other researchers' experimental data to validate their own CFD, which is what they're doing here. They are just doing their CFD, and then they're using published data to validate their CFD model. In a perfect world, that would be fine, but as it stands, this is often a recipe for inaccuracy. And there are a couple major reasons why this occurs. The first one is that you don't really know how rigorous the other researchers were with their research. For example, one thing that we go on about is how most researchers, and by most I mean 95% of people, don't even attempt to measure the density of air during their experiments. The density of air changes every day and every hour. So on a regular day, it changes between 2% and 4%, and between days, weeks, months, and seasons, these changes are more in the range of 5% to 15%. That introduces a random error into the experiment that the researchers aren't even aware of. And just as a side note, we actually manufacture an instrument to take care of this error. It's called Atmosphere Hawk, and you can find it in the literature. And the reason why it's important to keep track of the density of air is because, for example, in this particular case, you're using your experimental data to validate your CFD. You run your CFD at a certain density, but the density you're running it at is going to be different to your experiments because your experiments are obviously changing with the density in time. So you don't really know what the density is, and just getting a few percent change in your density will dramatically change the flow physics of your setup. And we actually did a podcast on this, podcast number 54, where we showed how changing the density by only 2% dramatically changed the stall pattern of an airfoil. So you can check that out as well if you like. So the second reason why using experimental data from other people to validate your own CFD is problematic is because you don't really know what their exact setup is. Even if you go to the most detailed method descriptions, there are always pieces of information missing. For example, how long ago were the mesh screens in the wind tunnel test were they claimed? So this is an important factor because while a wind tunnel might have a certain thermostensity level with clean screens, which is usually the thermostensity that most people quote. So when you like first build your wind tunnel, you go in there and you do maybe hot wire experiments, figure out what the thermostensity is, and then you'll say that that's the thermostensity level of the wind tunnel. And if the entire wind tunnel stays the same throughout its lifetime, then it will be the same. But the problem is that dust collects on the mesh screens over time, and that will change the thermostensity level as well as flow uniformity. And the reason why it changes flow uniformity is often because you have dust which is collecting on the screens over time, and every time you run the wind tunnel, stuff will get sucked in a little bit at a time, and it'll go through and get deposited on the screens. When you turn off your wind tunnel, that dust will then settle to the ground through gravity. So the bottom part of your screens usually will have more dust settling on there than the top part over time, and that means that the bottom part of your screens have a effectively a smaller opening for the flow to go through, which means that you have less flow going through there, and that will reduce the velocity there and increase the velocity on top, or at least the mass flow rate as well. And the thing is that most wind tunnel screens aren't really cleaned that regularly. So for example, I was once working in a facility with one of the best reputations in the world, and they hadn't cleaned their screens for like 20 years. And the idea of doing this was foreign to them, so I couldn't handle it because like it's just going to make your experiments worse. So I just got into the wind tunnel and cleaned it myself because no one else even really cared. So that's really a common problem, and if you're using another researcher's experimental data to validate your CFD, you have problems like that that are creeping in. You don't really know how rigorous they are. So that is why when I read researchers using other researchers' experimental data to validate their CFD, I get a little concerned. And this practice is becoming more and more common as research groups try to reduce expenses through getting rid of their wind tunnels or limiting the usage of them. But back to this study, they did also a mesh-independent study. They pitched the airfoil at 4 degrees and put it at 15% of the chord away from the ground. So that works out to be like 7.5 centimeters from the ground. And this is quite a standard practice, which is good. They're doing a mesh independent study, and they have three different mesh qualities, which is good as well. This is what you do in a typical mesh independent study, so they've done this quite well. They have a coarse mesh, which had a Y plus of 2. They had a medium mesh, which had a Y plus of 1. That's really nice. And they had a fine mesh, which had a Y plus of 0.5, which is even better. So they're all very good, especially considering that they are using the K-epsilon turbulence model. So for the K-epsilon turbulence model, usually a Y plus of around 30 is acceptable. So here they have 2 or lower, which is very good. Then they calculated the lift and drag coefficients for each one of these CFD meshes that they did. One thing that is surprising is that all meshes gave very similar results. The researchers wrote that the medium mesh was selected because there was almost no difference between the lift and drag of that mesh with the fine mesh. But even the coarse mesh only had a 1.6% change in the drag coefficient, and the lift coefficient was almost identical. So even the coarse mesh was not too bad. And given some other inaccuracies of the setup, you might potentially even be able to go with the coarse mesh and not really lose too much inaccuracy overall. But here they went for the medium mesh, and between the medium mesh and the fine meshes, the drag coefficients were only 0.3% different, and so they selected the medium mesh. And what's more, the lift coefficients were pretty much identical across all three meshes, like they changed by not even like 0.1%. And interestingly, they wanted to compare two different terminus models, the K-epsilon and the K-omega SST. To do that, they looked at the lift coefficient, and they have that in figure 5 here. So they ran the CFD setup with a medium mesh, from what I can tell, with their NACA 4412 airfoil with a K-epsilon and a K-omega SST terminus models for a whole bunch of range of angles attack from minus from 0 degrees to 18 degrees. And interestingly, looking at figure 5, both turbulence models worked well up to about 4 degrees. Then after that, there is a growing deviation. So the K omega SST sticks with the experimental results up to about 9 degrees. Then it starts to diverge for the lift coefficient. The K epsilon diverges slightly from the experimental results up until about 12 degrees before losing accuracy. So between 4 degrees and 12 degrees, it still kind of approximates the experimental results, but then after 12 degrees, it really falls off the experimental results. So in other words, the K omega SST loses accuracy after 11 degrees, the K epsilon after 12 degrees. And in other words, when the NACA 4412 airfoil starts to stall, neither turbulence model predicts it. So why does this happen? Why is there this inaccuracy between these two turbulence models and the experimental results? Well, it could be for a multitude of reasons, and many of them are centered around the fact that they didn't do the experimental research themselves, and as such, they don't know all of the facts. For example, these deviations in the stall regime could be easily due to the unknown changes in the air density. As we went through in podcast number 54, we showed that the air density does change the airfoil's performance, and this could be happening here. So from this study, the researchers decided to use a K-epsilon turbulence model. And let's look at the general results before concluding this podcast and covering the more detailed results in the next podcast. So let's move on to figure 6 here. In figure 6, they have the airfoil, the NACA 4412 airfoil at different angles of attack from 0 degrees to 18 degrees with the lift coefficient, drag coefficient, and the moment coefficient. So the moment coefficient is for the pitching moment, which is how much like the airfoil wants to nose up or nose down. And they have the lift and moment and drag coefficients plotted over the period of the wave. So from going from like one trough to the next trough. And they have angles of attack from 0 degrees to 18 degrees. Interestingly, the lift coefficient is quite sensitive to the wave at all angles of attack. For example, at 0 degrees, when the airfoil is producing the least amount of lift, it still fluctuates between 0 and 0.3, so it's quite a big fluctuation there. And if you increase the angle of attack to only even 2 degrees or 4 degrees, the effect of the wave actually drops a little. I don't know why, but I suspect it is because of how the airfoil is pitched. So if you pitch it a certain way, it may move the center of pressure away from the waves, which then may reduce the ground effect, which is what I think is happening there. I'm not too sure, but from the details that I have here, I think that's what's happening. By pitching the airfoil the way they're doing it, they're moving the center of pressure away from the waves, which then mitigates the ground effect. But then when you increase angle of attack more, the effect of the wave becomes more and more pronounced, comparable to the low angles of attack for the lift coefficient. For the moment and drag coefficients, they display the same trend in that as angle of attack increases, the effect of the wave increases. So at 0 degree angle of attack, there is almost no effect. You can see with the drag coefficient, it's very minor, the changes, as with the moment coefficient. Then when you go to 18 degrees, you get about a 15% change across the entire wave for the drag coefficient. So here you can see like it ranges for the 18 degree here between like 0.32 down to 0.27 perhaps. But for the moment coefficient, the moment coefficient changes by about 30% across the entire wave with the angle attack of 18 degrees. You can see here it goes between like minus 0.28 to minus 0.18. So the fact that the moment coefficient changes so much indicates that the wave is messing with where the center of pressure is on the airfoil, because this dramatically changes the pitching moment. Interestingly, the sine geometry of the wave does not reflect itself in these coefficients. So what I mean by that is that if you look at the lift coefficient in particular, the changes are not sinusoidal. You can see that they are somewhat like wavy, but they're definitely not symmetric about the trough and peak changes. There is a reduction to the waviness of them. But the reduction is usually over more one part of the period than over the other. So you can see here that like over the reduction takes place over even 80% of this period of the wave, while the increase occurs only over about maybe 20 or 30% of the wave. So it's really been truncated in one section and the reduction is elongated. So that's how the general effects of the wavy ground affects the airfoils. In the next podcast, we're going to be going through a lot more, such as the changes in percentages, the flow physics, as we have some graphs here showing the changes in flow physics, and the center of pressures, which will be quite interesting to go through. We'll get a few more answers here. But these are the initial results that we have found from this podcast, and we have found that the wavy ground really affects the aerodynamics. In the next podcast, we'll go through some of the reasons why that is. So that's in this podcast. If you liked it, make sure to like it. And if you want to see more like this, hit the subscribe button. And if you want to get better at CFD and or theory like this, check out our courses in the link in the description. And if you want to get better, if you want to get rid of your errors in your experiments from the density changes, get the MSU Hawk. It's an instrument we make to make your experiments far more accurate. You can find that in the link in the description as well. And until next time, peace out, amigos.